so much, everyone, for coming. It's such a great turnout. And thanks for being around all day today. I'm sure a lot of you were out and about at the different installations. And we're really lucky today to have two amazing thinkers and writers here to have a conversation about this landscape, this some of the pieces in the show, but really David and Josh both bring to the table lots of different ideas about sound and relationship to memory, personal memory, cultural memory, and landscape. Marfa's a remote place by any definition, and David came in from London, and we appreciate that. Josh from LA, which also, as I said, is remote by any stretch of the imagination. So I'll just tell you a little bit about both of them, and then I'll leave it to them. They're going to have an open conversation. There should be time at the end for questions and answers if anyone wants to engage in some of the topics that they're bringing up. And so David is a well-known author of many books about sound, including two recent books, Haunted Weather and Ocean of Sound. And he's currently working on his fifth book, Ways of Hearing, and is also busy composing a chamber opera. And he's curated also a lot of recent shows dealing with sound, including Sonic Boom at the Hayward and Playing John Cage at the Arnolfini in Bristol. Josh Kuhn is associate professor in the Annenberg School of Communications at USC. He's the director of the Popular Music Project at the Norman Lear Center and the author of Audiotopia, Music Race in America. And we have copies of Audiotopia and of several of David's books, both in the retail area and the library resource room of Ballroom, so I hope you guys will get a chance to check them out. Josh is also working on a new book, And You Shall Know Us by the Trail of Our Vinyl, The Jewish Past as Told by the Records We've Loved and Lost. And that's going to be at the New Jewish Museum in San Francisco as an exhibition in January of 2009. And he's currently writing a book on Tijuana, Mexico. So thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you. Just a couple of spatial observations. Because this is a conversation and Josh and I don't really know each other, we met for the first time yesterday. This is really an open conversation, so obviously there's a kind of awkwardness in us conversing in front of an audience. So if our backs are turned to any of you at any time, our apologies, it's nothing personal. The other thing is we decided not to have microphones because we think this space is great as it is. So I hope you can all hear us. My third observation is that I'm dustier than I would be for this kind of presentation. That's Martha. We haven't really talked a lot about what we're going to do, but we're both going to begin with just brief reflections on material that seems in some way to connect what we do. I arrived on Wednesday, and one of the first things I did was go into your wonderful bookshop. And I've been writing a little bit about Kafka recently. Kafka was troubled by sound. And I had also been... He wrote some very interesting little fragments on being very pained by day-to-day sound. And I'd also been researching the invention of the earplug, right? Which was actually invented by a German pharmacist at the beginning of the 20th century. And then I found a passage written by Kafka in one of his letters. He's writing like an advertising copywriter about these earplugs and saying what a fantastic invention they are. And he wore them day and night, and he said they solved all his problems because they cut out all external sound. And in the bookshop I found the Blue Octavo notebooks by Kafka, And I was sitting by the food shark reading them, and I met Charles here in the front row, and he said, "It's so great that you're reading Kafka in Marfa," which was very nice. But the first the first paragraph from the first notebook I'd like to read to you. Everyone carries a room about inside him. This fact can even be proved by means of the sense of hearing. If someone walks fast and one pricks up one's ears and listens, say in the night, when everything round about is quiet, one hears, for instance, the rattling of a mirror not quite firmly fastened to the wall. So, well, I mean, it's a great opener, but it's a puzzling paragraph. And I mentioned this to Josh, and he immediately said...
But there's a... See, we didn't rehearse anything. the composer Max Richter did an entire record based on the Blue Notebooks, and there's a piece that is set to those exact lines that the actress Tilda Swinton reads in the piece. It's a beautiful, beautiful composition, but it obviously is a piece that not only has resonance, I think for thinking about sound, but also composing for sound and creating sound out of that kind of a narrative.
I mean, I'm personally very interested in space and sound in space and the way sound behaves in space, but I've also been writing about sound and fear. One of the themes of my book is this idea that Freud wrote about the uncanny. So, unheimlich and heimlich, homely and unhomely. And I think sound is, and I think this is something Josh writes about beautifully, sound can be very much an expression of identity, and it can really conjure that feeling of homeliness. But then also it has this contrary power to unsettle, to create fear, to disturb us, to be invasive, to disrupt. I think in a way this is a strange paragraph. The more you read it, the more puzzling it becomes. But I think one of the things he's talking about, and one of the things that disturbed him so much, why he wore these German earplugs, was that sound can disturb your space. But it makes your space as well. You can make a space from it. Obviously, you can make an internal space, and you can carry that with you. And I first began thinking about this going back to a childhood memory. When I was a child, I found sound very disturbing. I would lie in bed at night in the dark, and I would hear very small sounds. And I would think that there was an intruder in the room. So if I lay there very quietly and didn't move, then I would imagine they would go away, and I would hear them moving around my bed. Now, I think I was probably reading a lot of Edgar Allan Poe at the time. So this whole idea of this contrary effect of sound is, I think, very important, the way it can create a very grounding sense in us, and then the way it can really disrupt that. And both of those qualities can be qualities, and they can be destructive forces. And I mean, I think I read that in your book, this kind of idea.
Yeah, it's certainly the way what you've written about also in Haunted Weather is that what is sound or music to one individual, or sound and music to one culture or a community, is complete noise and dissonance to another. And that the way that the categorizations that we bring to things like sound or music are always rooted in history, are always rooted in the specificity of who we are. That the idea of a universal, or at least I, in the work that I do, really resist the idea that there is this kind of idea of an absolute or universal music or an absolute or universal sound, but that these are things that are always involve some sort of relationship between the place that we listen, or the place that we make those sounds, or that those sounds are made, and the self or the subject that enters that space. That it's always relational, in that sense. And I mean, so much of your work deals with that in all kinds of different ways. And the very act of listening or ways of hearing, which is so suggestive, I think, always comes back to not just the places and the people or the cells, but also the bodies. And I was feeling that a lot today in listening in so many different kinds of spaces, is the way, obviously, so many different kinds of sounds can have different kinds of effects on the body. And it's always a really good reminder, and when I working with my students on this, to get them to always, even if they're intellectualizing sound or intellectualizing music, to always come back to it and thinking about it in terms of their bodies, about how it makes them feel, how it makes them move, how it makes them comfortable or very uncomfortable, healthy feeling or sick feeling. It's so obviously so caught up in intimate ways with our sense of the world in that way.
But our sense of the world is so complex now. You write about American music, and American music is one of the biggest influences on my life. Forgive me for saying this, but perhaps not so much now. But certainly from when I was...
We will go on.
We will go on, yeah. You have something more to say. But coming to Marfa, one of the first things I heard getting into Marfa late at night was the train whistle. It suddenly struck me with extraordinary force that despite the fact I've been coming to the States since 1978 on a fairly regular basis, I'd never actually heard that in situ. And, you know, that sound, I mean, whether it's Hank Williams or Howlin' Wolf or The Beach Boys or countless movies, in a sense shaped a whole part of me from very early life. And there I was growing up in the suburbs of London and having this very long distance relationship with the culture. And, you know, again, the uncanny, because it is an uncanny sound, I think, but it's kept me awake every night. Damn sound. And, so, you know, it's always complex, isn't it? It's, yeah. You know, and in some ways I feel a sense of, I'm at home. The first time I ever went to New York was in 1978, and I suddenly felt, I'm home. And this was from watching TV series like Naked City, you know, as a kid, you know, and Dragnet and all this stuff, and some part of me responding to that. And on the other hand, it's quite alien. It's such a different culture, despite the shared language, or, you know, the English part of American language.
Well, that train whistle, I've been thinking a lot in the past couple months of at the Autry Museum in Los Angeles. The Institute of the American West is doing a project over the next couple of years around what they're calling the Sonic West or the Oral West. And I'm doing some work with them on this, and so I've just been kind of obsessing over this idea of the Sonic American West. And obviously the train whistle is something that would be probably in, you know, if you're doing Family Feud version of top 10 sound. Hooves. I think in a catalog of what is sonically synonymous with the American West, that's certainly part of it. And there's this wonderful recent novel by Marianne Wiggins called The Shadow Catcher. I don't know if people have had a chance to read yet. That's based on her quest as a nonfiction writer to write about the photography of Edward Curtis, and really about the kind of fraudulent photography of Curtis and the fraudulent authenticity of Native American life in those photographs. And she turns it into a novel that is a kind of a fake piece of nonfiction. And there's a passage about between a mother and daughter who are part of Curtis's family in the American West that I wanted to read, because I think it speaks to all these things that we've been thinking about as well. The conversation, it starts like this. "Sometimes I dream for it to snow," Amelia said. "I will it." She drew a finger to her lips to signal quiet. "Do you hear it?" Clara strained to hear a sound through all of the silence. "Hear what, mother?" "The acoustics. The whole world's a concert hall." And what I loved about that is that they weren't in a concert hall. They were not concert hall people. And they were not high culture in the in the scope of the novel, but that the idea that, that the world itself, the acoustic ecology, a phrase that I know we both like from Schaeffer, and the you know, the idea of the kind of natural sounds of the world on the one hand, but on the other, this larger world of what are the concerts going on every day, be it the train whistle. And when I was driving in, a lot of the work that I'm doing right now is on Mexican music, and you know, particularly Mexican migrant music across the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly California and northern Mexico. But I was listening to some of the many norteño stations just outside of El Paso, and there's one called La Magia, and it's the magic station, and it's all traditional norteño country music and banda. But the tagline for the station I loved was, you know, the magic. Music magically crossing borders, and which I thought was really interesting because it was as if music didn't cross borders, which is always kind of the cliche of what music is. But it also then struck me, well, sure, this is coming out of a context of where even music in this landscape can be stopped, right? Can be policed and controlled. Talk about what is safe music or unsafe music in certain landscapes. And I, in the piece last night, in your piece at the foundation last night, what I thought was so interesting was when you guys were inside performing, and there was this wall between us that we could see through, but it was this wall, and there was all of this sound freely happening on the inside, yet there was this kind of carceral sense in some way that, you know, you were trapped inside and we were watching you. And the Border Patrol station is obviously spitting distance, right? And it was too much for me to take in the way that, that so many of the pieces that, that I've seen speak to this duality, a sonic duality of this landscape. You know, that here we have the Border Patrol station, but we also have this landscape that, you know, obviously calls up things like Giant or There Will Be Blood, the idea of Western myth and Western promise and opportunity and freedom on the one hand, and then intense carceral situations on the other, and intense death and intense longing, and real invisibility that I see here also, that I know is a real part of the Marfa experience as well. But I think that those are things that are really important in this landscape that I've been thinking about through sound, is the way that, you know, this sonic West, but then stuff I've been thinking about the sonic border or the oral border, about how they're, I was almost like imagining the desert, the Western deserts as a kind of DJ mixing board where, you know, if you use a crossfader on it, that on channel one, you've got the American West, and on channel two, you've got the Mexican border. And they're not the same soundscapes. They overlap, they bump into each other, they clash, they influence each other without them knowing it. But when I was driving here, being able to switch the channels on the radio a bit, you could hear them folding in. And so many of the pieces, I was so happy to, and maybe I was reading into so many of them, who knows, but I was really hearing that in so many of the pieces today, the way these two different channels were crossing and fading into each other.
I think it's also true of the way we think about music. I wrote a book called Ocean of Sound in 95, and I think I'd reached a point where I was just so frustrated with this this lack of acceptance that musics overlap and they bleed into each other and they speak to each other, and people have, they can have quite complex identities in terms of the way they relate to different kinds of music, and then the complexity of the way that fits into the wider sound world. And so I wanted to write a book which was, I began with a phase of electronic music, ambient music, and then went back to a symbolic beginning, if you like, of ambient music, which, and I chose this point of Debussy hearing Javanese music in Paris at the end of the 19th century at one of these big colonial expositions, and suddenly acknowledging that non-European cultures could make music that was surprising and sophisticated and beautiful and just as valid as classical music, as we call it. But I felt it was very important to write about, well, a history of 20th century music, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, which was inclusive. that acknowledge the role of somebody like Sun Ra alongside somebody like Stockhausen, and then acknowledge emergent electronic musicians like Aphex Twin alongside pioneers like Pierre Schaeffer. I think what was interesting about that book was that a lot of people responded to it. I mean, particularly people a lot younger than me, which is kind of always nice. but then you get the problem in the academy, don't you? You get
this. We have no problems in the academy.
Is that right? where you're seen as a kind of generalist, and you know, you can't really possibly know enough because you're addressing too many issues simultaneously. And so I have this peculiar relationship with the academy where I'm sort of in it and out of it, and I speak at conferences, and I always feel I'm kind of tolerated, and that certain aspects of what I do is okay, but other things are not okay because it's just not precise enough. It's, you know, and it's, to me, it's an ongoing conflict, this thing, because to me that doesn't reflect people's realities. You know, what's so interesting about, for example, going to literature and finding these references, these wonderful references to silences and to listening, to acts of listening, and then you feel this kind of complex relationship people have to their environment, which is so little spoken about, so little articulated.
I mean, don't you think part of that complexity and that experience is the privacy element?
Yeah.
Of being able to, that of those moments, those incredibly liberating moments where you can be, you're alone and can put on whatever you want to listen to, right? And that in a way, at least, maybe now I'm like projecting, but that's, at least for me, that's how, when I was a kid listening, I was able to make up these worlds and make up these identities and try on selves and try on languages and sounds through these kind of rehearsals, kind of sonic drag in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, listening alone, and you had the freedom because no one was watching you. There was no peer pressure, and you weren't being judged, and you could just listen freely. But I think the idea of that you said of, you know, the academy wanting, you know, accusing you of being all over the place or of not specializing, it's a real issue, and it's something that, I mean, well, one, the way that the arts are studied in the academy is very unhealthy in general, which is that most academics, not all, but most like to carve up territory and own that territory and kill any love or passion that ever existed and claim it. And music's a really bad thing to study if that's your goal, I think, because part of, I think it's safe to say one of the things that attracts both of us to thinking about sound and music is the drift factor, and that you start thinking in one way and it leads you somewhere else, and one sound connects to another and echoes something else and connects up with ghosts and pasts and futures and presents, and to then police that and say, no, stop, I'm only talking about this, is disingenuous and dishonest to the art.
Well, to my mind, a person is not a person. A person is a collection of many fragments and sensations and identities and semi-understood tremors. And this process of, I mean, particularly in formative years of, you know, you test it out in a way, don't you, with listening to different forms of music. And of course we've grown up, we've all grown up with the kind of record player or the, you know, and all the stages in between to the MP3 player and the iPod, and in a way, the further you go with the technology, the more you sense that, this relationship to music, which is, I'm this kind of person, right. And now I'm segueing into this kind of person, and I become montages of all these different. But I like, you know, what you say about the silences is very interesting. I started writing this new book, Ways of Hearing, through revisiting John Berger's book, Ways of Seeing, which I'd read maybe when I was an art student in the late 60s. You know, it's kind of well, it's illegal not to read it, I think. and kind of putting that down and forgetting about it, and then coming back to it, and I really can't remember why. And one of the interesting things about that book is that the first sentence is a mistake. Because what he infers is that the first experience a child has is seeing. And what he's trying to say is that the first experience the child has is seeing rather than text, rather than words, writing, which is true. But of course the first experience the child has is not seeing at all. It's some kind of uterine tactile audio sense. So that's how we begin. We begin as eavesdroppers on an unknown world. So I thought, well, you know, there is no ways of hearing as an equivalent of Burgess' book. And then there's an interesting passage in the book where he's writing about Vermeer, and he talks about the silence of Vermeer and the way that we connect with a painting through the painter's brushstrokes. And there is a kind of silence in that. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. And then I came across this 17th century Dutch painter called Nicolas Maas, who was from Dordrecht. And he, as a teenager, he went and he worked in Rembrandt's studio. His first paintings were under the influence of Rembrandt. And then he painted these very distinctive genre scenes. And he painted a series of six paintings called The Eavesdropper. Four of them are in London, happily for me. And what they show is, they show different scenes, but they're variations on a scene, which is a woman is in the centre of the picture in five of them. And she's listening to a scene with a maid. There's a kind of erotic scene always in one corner of the picture in this complex interior. And she's listening to what's going on, and she has a finger on her lips, so she's saying to you, the person who is the beholder, many centuries ahead, listen to this. And I thought, well, that's, I can't really think of any other clear instance of a representation of the act of listening. And of course, once you go into 17th century Dutch art, it's full of sound, and it's also full of silence. And Maas painted a number of beautiful scenes of usually domestic scenes, interiors, almost always women involved in either domestic activities, peeling parsnips, or sometimes sleeping, reading. I mean, reading and sleeping are very common themes in art of that time and before. What's interesting about this is how we begin to describe silence, and I think it's very relevant to this environment, but it's relevant to other environments. I was in Norway 2 weeks ago, and Norway has a very different kind of silence. So there are many silences. And silence, one of the things about silence, I think, is that we've kind of been trained since John Cage to say there's no such thing as silence. And although that's true, it deprives us of an important metaphor. So if we want to talk about annihilation, ethnic cleansing, voids, the end of the world, environmental catastrophe, you know, I mean, all these subjects, then silence is a really, really valuable concept to have as a metaphor. Or repression, political repression, or interpersonal conflict. Silence is so valuable. And this I find kind of fascinating, because I mean, I do experiments. I guess everybody who works with sound does these kind of personal experiments. And the revelation I had, and I mean, I've talked about this before, so apologies for those of you who've heard me talk about this, but at home I have a Japanese garden, my house, which I've made. And I sit out there sometimes, and there was one occasion, couple of years ago, and I was sitting out there, and it was very quiet. And where I live in London is actually quieter than Marfa, strangely enough. And I could hear this very tiny sound. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And in the end, it was springtime. And what I realized it was in the end was the snails and slugs eating my plants. So the deeper you get into silence, the noisier it becomes. This is the contradiction, you know. And we've all been getting incredibly excited today, haven't we, about these red bugs. Somebody tell us what they are. These cicadas that just take off, and they're bright red, and they make this incredible rattling sound. What are they?
Grasshoppers.
Grasshoppers. Come on.
You kind of do better than that. They look like grasshoppers.
But they're a special kind of grasshopper. I mean, really. We don't have grasshoppers like that that make this kind of rattling sound in England.
I just want to pick up on the silence thing, because it... No, because it's...
Stop me.
No. Because it's really, really, really important for this landscape. And in so much of writing on the Western Desert, there's very little that's been written actually about the sounds of the desert, and very little that's been written about the music of the desert, and so much that is, if you read 19th century surveying... essays and explorer essays, it's all about the profound silence of the desert, which is true.
Yeah.
Though it is also a lie. Yes. Right? So it's both. Because if you ever went to any part of the desert now, it's much harder to actually find desert silence than it was in the 19th century. You'll immediately be bombarded by all kinds of sounds, all kinds of, you know, very minuscule events that become very loud when you hear them. But what's been interesting in looking at all that stuff is that, and this really goes well to what I thought was such a great point you just made about how much we need silence, actually, as a term to talk about erasures and omissions in history, is that part of, you know, when Anglo explorers would come west, they would always write about the desert as empty. And that's what attracted them to, you know, for westward expansion, is that that it was an empty desert. Well, it was either empty because it had been cleared, or it was empty because they were making it empty by writing it into emptiness, and you know, by writing Native Americans out of history, by writing Mexicans out of the Southwest, by writing Asian laborers out of the Southwest. It's empty. It's all for us. It's a place for Anglo, particularly Anglo men, to remake themselves as the rugged individualists. And I think that it's, and so much has been written, I'm really recycling what so many American historians have said over the past 50 years about that, and rewriting the West. But no one talks about the way that the kind of equivalent in an auditory way of the emptiness of the West is its silence. And I think it's been equally dangerous over the last century to keep repeating this mantra that, oh, it's so silent in the desert, it's so silent, and because it's romantic and it's seductive and we get caught up, and of course it's silent, but it's also not silent at all. And by refusing to listen to these sounds that are being made, we really are committing these kinds of erasures and committing these absences and making them permanent in ways that can't happen anymore. And I mean, certainly in the case of, again, not to use the same example, but in the case of Mexican migrant music, it's, you know, I live in Los Angeles, in a city that is now nearly 40% Mexican, not 40% Latino, but 40% Mexican. The Mexican migrant music industry, the so-called regional Mexican music, Norteños and Banda, this is one of the largest, biggest money-making commercial music industries in the country. And yet it is unheard. It is silent in the American mainstream. And so I think that this register of what we hear and what remains silent is still, it's so culturally important. And yeah, you had actually been pointing out to me in the artist statement of the
Christina Kubitsch.
The Kubitsch piece about what she says about European.
Yeah, I love this
history.
Yeah.
Cue.
Well, I mean, I know Christina really well, and she's a friend, and you know, I really like her work, but I just picked up the statement and I really liked it. But I really like what she said about Europe, which is kind of obsessed with preserving, you know, conservation. And is a kind of disease, and of course it's a great thing because we have so many wonderful museums and so much heritage. I mean we kind of drown in heritage, and I love that. But there's a nostalgia in that. There's a kind of death in that as well. And you know, I like the fact that she chose to just say, "Okay, none of that. I'm just going to put you in this invisible digital world and make what you can of that." And I stood in that room and I was just looking at the grain of the wood and the cobwebs and the dust, and I felt much more closely connected, I think, to that than I would have done if she had come here as an outsider and made a kind of literal interpretation. But I'm conscious that time is racing, and one other thing I did feel that we should talk about is there's an important idea that connects us both very strongly, and we both have different terms for it that we've both stolen from other people. And my turn is visiocentrism, and Josh's is
ocular centrism.
Ocular centrism, which is very difficult. They're both difficult Dueling words. Yeah. Where they're both these kind of ugly words, but. And I did the Chinati tour yesterday, and I picked up this one of the foundation newsletters, and I'm actually writing an essay at the moment on voids for an art catalogue for an exhibition that will happen next year at the Pompidou, which is called Voids, and it's going to be empty exhibitions. And so I've been asked to write about emptiness in sound, which is kind of difficult. it's a very seductive topic, actually. But I picked up this, and I was reading this piece about Robert Irwin. I mean, it's a great thing to do. You know, one of the spiritual homes of minimalism, having just done the tour, and then to be reading at Chinati, to be reading this piece about Robert Irwin. It's about an experiment from 1968 where Irwin and Tenney went to UCLA and went into their anechoic chamber and did these kind of sensory deprivation experiments. And I mean, they were a popular thing to do in the 60s. You know, John Lilly took it to the max, really, by spending, I think, weeks underwater. But what's really extraordinary about this passage, you know, they went into the anechoic chamber and they sat there in the dark for hours and hours and hours. And maybe it's the fault of the writer, but no reference is made to what they heard. It's all about visual hallucinations and visual memories. And I mean, this idea, which is absolutely right, that given deprivation, the body will instantly respond over time by, filling up the void with sensory material. But there's nothing here about what they heard. Now, maybe they heard a lot and they wrote about it, and it's just not in here. But it made me think that, you know, this is an important link in what we're trying to do. But it's an idea that leads you off into so many different places.
For example.
For example.
Well, I mean, one of the places
we have nothing to say about it except void.
You're right. I mean, one of the places that it leads is a very kind of grandmaster narrative place, which is a rethinking of Western history and Western philosophy in some ways. In all seriousness, of actually
10 minutes, Josh.
Thinking about it. No. This is a footnote. There have been great books written on this that I have written. That really just, and I think it's something that I'm sure with your students, I mean, that you do, which is to ask the question: what does it mean to think with your ears? What does it mean to think critically? Through an auditory avenue, and that's why I think, you know, in seeing the pieces today, And particularly, actually, going back to what you were saying earlier, and another great thing you said about eavesdropping, which I thought was really, really interesting, the line between eavesdropping and surveillance, right? And that what particularly, I apologize to the makers of this piece, because you should know it's only being referred to all day as the horse piece, but which was great. But the way that those horses, as kind of sonic carriers, spoke to these different ideas of eavesdropping on the one hand, that the horses were eavesdropping through scanning, but eavesdropping as a response to surveillance, right, which is a much more aggressive form of eavesdropping. And it made me think also just about the different ways that eavesdropping can happen and surveillance can happen, and so much in the terms of this landscape of the Southwest and U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Obviously, surveillance is a very long-standing tradition and a very controversial one for some now, and a very intense and urgent one now. But I've been working on this book about particularly the California-Mexico border, city of Tijuana itself, and there's this great moment in the 1950s and 60s in Tijuana where, because of FCC regulations, U.S. Radio stations went south of the border, as many of you probably know, to broadcast outside of regulatory rules. And so there were all of these U.S. radio stations broadcasting from Mexico, from northern Mexico. Wolfman Jack, most famously, was broadcasting just south of TJ. Quintessential American soundscapes were coming from Mexico. First 24-hour all-news radio network was actually broadcast from Tijuana in English. But what it did, what was so incredible, is because it was pirate radio, all of these frequencies and vibrations went up in the air, and all the Mexicans in Tijuana eavesdropped and pulled it down. They were not the intended audience, and they just grabbed these sounds. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the first real rock scene in Mexico was not in Mexico City, but in Tijuana. And it was in English, because everyone grew up listening to Fats Domino and Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry because of these frequencies that were floating over their heads, that they were eavesdropping on, right? Yeah. Sounds that weren't meant for them that became theirs. And I think that that is at least one example of the really, I think, the complex ways that as listeners, we are pulled into these relationships that can be very unpredictable and very productive, and also I think kind of scary sometimes, because it is this leap into an unknown that is always present.
I did it with Voice of America when I was a young teenager, and hearing, I started playing guitar in a blues band when I was like 14, 15. And part of that comes from listening to Voice of America. And then I started to hear bits of free jazz on, who was it? Willis Conover on Voice of America. And he was playing, not quite really out free jazz, but like, more adventurous Tony Williams recordings on Blue Note and the things that leaned towards free jazz in that period. And that was really revelatory. And of course, it was Voice of America wasn't meant for me,
right.
Kind of, teenager growing up in the suburbs of London.
Mm-hmm.
But it changes your life, you know. I said to somebody the other day, "Oh, American music changed my life," and they looked at me like I was crazy, you know. So. But it's actually true, because, you know, these experiences, and then later on writing a book about hip-hop, which... I didn't write that book to create the effect it created, but through that I became a full-time writer for 10 years. These things can really...
I will say that as someone who that book really was very impactful on me, The Rap Attack, and that was a book that I can say though that all friends of mine, music fans and critic friends alike, when we all were obsessing over it and reading it, and it was like, he's British. What? That's wrong. Why has someone from the U.S. not written this book? But I think it also speaks to like that gap at that time of what was not being heard in the United States that was being heard in different ways.
There is a tradition which I feel quite proud of British writers writing about American music. Paul Oliver is a good example. He wrote fantastic, analytical, intelligent, enlightened material about the blues from very early on, which came from his experience actually during the Second World War. And as a child, he crept up to a US Air Force base or Army base, and there were two black men working and singing a work song. And he said, you know, the effect of that on him was just chilling. I mean, he didn't understand where it came from, but he just connected with it immediately and wanted to find out more about it. And he wrote so brilliantly about blues, I think. And so there is a tradition. I mean, you know, obviously you come in for some harsh treatment also, which is fair enough, you know. Sure. I did come in very much as an outsider, but I think you can come in as an outsider and realize something is going on that the people within it are not totally aware of, mm-hmm. you know, because they're in it. I mean, that's true for any of us. We're inside something and we don't have that bigger perspective. So, yeah, being a sort of white guy from England was, people were very open to me in talking about what they were doing. And I think that's because you are an outsider. Mm-hmm. Less so now, of course, because it's so much bound up in corporate stuff. But then, when it was more of a grassroots movement, and was very exciting from that point of view. Yeah. But there was something else I was going to say there. And well, never mind. I think we should, if any of you have questions or comments, please feel free to ask us. And if you... Yeah, hi.
Could you read that Kafka thing again?
Yeah, sure. I didn't know my reading was that good. You know, I had to read it a few times, and then I thought I knew what he meant, and then I suddenly thought, I don't know what he's talking about. Everyone carries a room about inside him. This fact can even be proved by means of the sense of hearing. If someone walks fast and one pricks up one's ears and listens, say in the night, when everything round about is quiet, one hears, for instance, the rattling of a mirror not quite firmly fastened to the wall. I mean, did you take anything from that passage that, or were you just, did it fly by too quickly and you were puzzled by it?
You know, I just wanted to hear it again because I didn't get it all the first time.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've been really concentrating on, and I had this conversation with Bob over there, who was creating sound so brilliantly for Stephen last night, and Bob was saying some great stuff about these threshold areas of hearing, and these I don't know what to call them, micro intensities of listening, which are actually, you're not sure whether they're external or internal, and you know, particularly at night, you hear sounds. And I mean, I composed a piece earlier this year. I was commissioned to compose a piece for an ensemble in Cork in Ireland, and I wanted to do a piece about sleeping. And we have a dog at home, a miniature schnauzer, and she sleeps on our bed, and she snores. And I tend to go to sleep later than my wife does, so she goes to sleep immediately and I'm reading. And the dog is snoring, and I got to the point where I found it so comical that I started to record it. So I thought that's a great beginning for a piece. And then I was researching all this stuff on 17th century Dutch painting and looking at all these extraordinary paintings by Maas and Vermeer and Rembrandt of people reading and sleeping. So I thought, well, And I didn't mention this to Paul, but this might be very interesting to him. I thought I'll record a piece of me reading. And I've worked with the same sound engineer since 1979. He was the engineer on this session for a band called The Flying Lizards, who some of you may have heard of, and I was kind of part of that for a while. And I've kept friendship and association with this guy, and he's done so many different things with me and other people that you can go and say anything to him. I think, a bit like Bob there, you could say anything and he'll just say, oh, okay. And I said, I want to record reading. And I said, but not reading aloud. And he was just, okay. So he set up his best microphones. And I took along a book that I thought was appropriate, which was a 19th century edition of Montaigne's essays. And for 20 minutes, I just read the essays, and he recorded. And it's actually really interesting. I mean, far more interesting than you would think, because first of all, you have the air of the room, and I was talking to Lucy about this earlier, that, David Lynch has this thing about the sound of the air in rooms, and I love that too. And then you have your breathing, and the pages being turned, and all these minuscule movements, and then you begin to realize, and actually my body's suddenly doing it now in response, that all these internal sounds, which are probably happening all the time, but you don't hear them, these very subtle little stomach gurglings are actually quite loud. And so you get all that too. And so this, to me, is this idea, this Kafka idea of the space inside, And I think he's hearing sounds which are tiny, and you begin to question yourself, is it outside, is it something I need to be fearful of, or is it a comfortable sound from outside, or is it inside, and what's the difference? Because that's the nature of sound, isn't it? That, it's this strange penetrating, emissive business. So it's, where is it? It's never quite anywhere. So we're constantly, it's moving through spaces continually.
And he's got this other in Investigation of the Dog, where he talks, yeah, where he writes about this from the perspective of being a dog, and then he hanging out with all the other dogs, and not in this terror that he fears that as the dog, that he won't recognize his barking in the barking of the other dogs. And that there's all, I think that runs through so much of his work that...
Well, the burrow.
The burrow
is a great one, where mole creature or whatever is making this perfectly safe environment underground. And it's obsessive, visuocentric and spatiocentric attention to detail. And then suddenly he hears this noise and it's like... The whole thing falls apart, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like paranoid listening, I call it. Yeah.
Why do you think people in the Western world are so visuocentric or oculocentric?
Do you think it's just the Western world?
I'd say predominantly the Western world. I'm comparing it with hunter-gatherers. How far back do you want to go?
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense. If not everybody has all their senses, we have to always remember that in talking about the senses. I had a fantastic conversation the year before last. I went to a Christian Marclay show opening at White Cube. This piece called Crossfire, where you just stand in the middle of people shooting at you. It's a great piece. And Christian introduced me to this woman who had been working as an assistant to him. And I said hi, and he said, you have to write. And she was deaf, she didn't speak. And we started having Louise Stern, and she works as an assistant to Sam Taylor Wood. And so we had this incredible conversation of writing and passing her notebook back and forth. And she was this incredible anger came through, particularly directed against John Cage, you know, that all his ideas about silence were had completely ignored the fact that certain people can't hear, you know. So, this kind of rocked me back on my heels, and it was one of those great conversations where you're really challenged by what somebody is saying, and you think, everything I think is wrong. You know, and those conversations are really unsettling and wonderful. But, you know, seeing makes a lot of sense because it connects so much with the idea of being in space and touching and all those things. I mean, the literature of visual culture is vast, isn't it?
One response that there's a really a book you might find interesting called Downcast Eyes. That's basically by Martin Jay. That documents this idea of ocular centrism in the West. But one of the things that he points out is the extent to which the dominant ideas of Western philosophical liberal thought, i.e., the Enlightenment, based on things that we take for granted as self-evident, like reason or rationality or common sense, were all based, kind of linked up with this notion of clear seeing and vision. That vision became the sense of the enlightened subject. And so in the U.S., at least, as a country built upon, even if it was full of fiction and flaws and complete lies, the idea of the enlightenment subject was this perfect self, right, that all the senses were functioning, but it was the clarity of vision. And also, I think, you know, many people, and I think you actually quibble with this a bit, and I think Haunted Weather, the idea that vision is the more controlled sense, because it's something that by blinking or closing our eyes that we can actually control more of what we see versus hearing, where we're always kind of always open, and things are just can bombard us, and we can shut our eyes, but we can't shut our ears in the same kind of a way. So I think it's wrapped up in that. I mean, it's a great question, and I think it's one that it'd be can't be answered in one at least one book. But it's a great question.
Is it possible that it's just because we're mobile beings and it's just a navigation tool, and because it's a tool, it has it's become such a dominant.
But hearing is such a great navigation tool. Yes.
I think dolphins.
If you can't hear, then there's a good possibility that you're going to be knocked down by a truck. If silent cars are developed, and hopefully they will be, then it's going to be a major issue. And
imagine silent trains. You're in trouble. You're going, no more Marfa for you, my friend.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Nina, did you want to?
I was going to say just apropos by now many things that you both said, but apropos the excerpt you read from the Tsunami newsletter and silence and the body. And now, I guess I also have to invoke Cage. Is that okay? After
if we have to.
But there's that great, great Cage anecdote in Determinacy where he talks about being taken into an anechoic chamber, and as he's in there, listening, there's still these two sounds that he hears, and it's finally explained to him that one of the sounds is the sound of his blood system, and the other one, I forget, is his heart in here. But it just made me think that even when we have supposed silence, we have to kind of contend with ourselves and with our own bodies, and hopefully it is making sound because it proves to us that we're here. So.
Well, yeah, I don't think we have to contend with them. they are us, mm-hmm. And it's. I think, there's a sense of impoverishment. I mean, certainly the language, once you begin to examine language, it's so visuocentric, and the vocabulary available to us to describe acts of hearing and listening is very tiny. So, I think the more we become aware of these things, the better. But this story of Cage is interesting because it's like Moses and the tablets now. And somebody said to me in Germany a few years ago, what was actually said to him was that it's your blood and your neural processing. Somebody said to him, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's possible. And I've wondered about that. Certainly the pulsing of the blood. But Bob was talking there the other night about autoacoustic emissions, and you were saying you do an experiment with your students where you put a I mean, you should say this, yes.
The ear emits sounds.
The ear emits sounds.
Very, very quiet sounds, and they're inhibited. We don't hear them. But if you put a microphone, a tiny little microphone in your ear canal, you can listen to those sounds and measure them and record them. And they're different for everybody. And it's an artifact of the hearing process.
Yeah. So what this person was saying to me in Germany was that he thought the frequency made it impossible. I don't know. I'm not a neurologist.
He's been hearing of these
auto-acoustic emissions. Yes.
And they weren't really recognized until like the 70s.
No, it's a recent thing, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. So the engineer in the, was probably wrong. And nobody talks about this, but this kind
it's
of
a great
central
story.
Well, it's a central story. It's like this kind of chapter from the Bible in terms of 20th century audio culture, and right. It's a little bit like the John Berger first sentence, you know, it's probably wrong. Which is great,
because like just Steve Reich has a just a quick follow-up, and then yes, he talks about. So it was in an interview with Steve Reich, and they said, you know, talking about where his inspiration for composing and for, you know, various pieces, and he said for him it's always about pulse, though I think whether it's true or not true, which is a good argument to have over here, one thing it does speak to is this notion of the kind of the relationship between creativity and music making, and the pulse of life, and that in that sense that I think fuels so much of what everyone in here has been making.
I guess I just wanted to say something about like the biological process of the difference between hearing and seeing. I mean, when you're hearing, something is actually, your cells are actually moving around. I mean, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the experiments of Hans Jenny, or even just, you know, well, the sonic bed was a good example. I mean, you're lying on the bed and you can feel your physical self, your skin, you know, you're actually vibrating. Whereas when you're seeing something, there's a different biological process that's happening, but it's not changing you physiologically. And I think that in many ways, sound actually causes a physical effect. The experiments of Hans Jenny are really cool. They're basically just a plate on top of a speaker with sand on it. And the sand vibrates on the plate and creates these shapes, these incredible shapes. So you're talking about this kind of argument between sound and visual, but they're two totally different processes.
Sure.
And I just also wanted to mention that this place, Marfa, obviously gets a lot of play for its landscape. I'm so happy that the Ballroom did the show, because finally the soundscape is getting some press. And I moved here because of the soundscape, because of that subtleness. Well, exactly what you were talking about the thresholds of sound. And when I came here, I came to Fort Davis, it was almost as if I could hear the landscape itself. I mean, it was loud. You know, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the rocks emitting something or the trees. I don't know what it is, but it's suddenly you can hear something that you couldn't hear living in your apartment next to the BQE. And it becomes very
what?
Like, thank you so much for this inspiring.
There's a writer we both like a lot. I think you like him. You write about him a lot. Armory Schaefer. You write about him a lot. As a phrase that I like you've written about called sound, instead of landmarks, he talks about sound marks, and that the ways that sounds can become ways of creating a sense of community, can actually bring a group of strangers into some sort of relationship because of the commonality of a certain sound that repeats or that it becomes familiar, and you know the way that soundscapes become ways of building community and
the train. I met Murray and some of the people from the World Soundscape Project. If somebody doesn't know about this is a pioneering project in Vancouver, Simon Fraser University. Murray Schaefer was a teacher in the 1960s, and he used ideas from contemporary music, people like Cage, in his teaching of young people. And he developed this research project at Simon Fraser University where they began to explore acoustic ecology and the soundscape. And, you know, it was a great thing, and it really kicked off an enormous amount of activity. On the one hand, a lot of people working with sound. I don't really like the term sound art, but people working with sound. But also, in recent years, this whole fascinating area of, well, it has a lot of ugly names, but historians going back and beginning to ausculcate the past, the sounds of the past, and a lot of that is informed by Murray Schafer. But I have a lot of problems with Murray's work because it's deeply conservative, I think, and it's anti-urban, and it's actually, in a way, it's kind of physiocentric in the end. I think, you know, this term soundscape is quite problematic in the end. It's so embedded with landscape, and so the idea of a soundscape is that you're standing in front of it, and I think that's a real problem. Murray's become more and more conservative as he's got older, which
that's
can happen. We sort of have to work on that, but you know, I think the reason I feel strongly about it is because it informs so much of the debate about sound, and it has so many traps within it. So, yeah, but you know, not to take anything away from him, inspiring and important and innovative and certainly important to me.
I mean, he created a lexicon that people can use or throw out or...
Well, he created a lexicon which people can argue with, and that in itself is a great thing in this impoverished vocabulary of ours. Anybody else? Yeah.
I was just sort of reflecting on the idea of sounds and visuals sort of being disparate, but I wanted to sort of just make a comment about how they're in fact the same. Just going into the physics of it, which is in fact that they're both frequencies, like the act of hearing something, the act of seeing something, or it stems on the idea that there are frequencies that we hear or frequencies that we see.
Yes. Yes, it's true. And again, we come back to this idea that senses are really not separate.
Yeah, it's false opposition.
It's false, yeah. This idea of compartmentalizing the senses and thinking that taste is somehow radically different. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, lives are structured around this. You know, economies are structured around this. And I find it completely false. I was very struck, you know, David Hockney has been making these, when he has a moment in between talking about bans on smoking, he sometimes says, you know, that we're just living in an oral age. And it's funny because everybody says, oh, everything is visual and sound has a bad time of it. But Hockney is exactly the opposite. He says, oh, everyone's walking around with things in their ears and nobody can look anymore. And, well, in fact, if you go back to the 60s, when he did Rake's Progress, and one of his etchings is like a line of figures looking like robots, all dressed identically with headphones. So he's, you know, this has been an obsession for him for a long time, but he's progressively been growing deaf. So I think that is a big factor. You know, he had to stop working on operas, for example, because he got to the point where he could no longer really hear the music. And, you know, I think a lot of people have this idea that if one sense is affected, then the other senses can be accentuated. I've been short-sighted since I was about 10, 11 years old, and it was a very traumatic experience for me to start to lose my sight. And I often wonder if that's the reason why I kind of brought to life a so-called career around sound. You know, so I think they are connected, and as you rightly say, they are connected at the level of physics.
And I think also at another level, I mean, I spent a lot of time watching, in the studio, watching musicians record, and in the last 10 years, the way that, for example, Pro Tools is now, you know, taking over, that recording and engineering has become so much more of a visual process, where engineers and producers who are not even so musically inclined can do it visually just by saying, well, there's a break there, or just look there where it goes there. And it becomes a visual language for talking about sonic production. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the two languages. And I think anyone who's most all histories of sound and noise usually start with at least some caveat that these are not histories that are separate from the visual, but inform each other.
Yeah. The waveform idea is... Yeah, it's very powerful, in fact, and you become... I was composing a piece, like a kind of mini opera last year, and the notation began with just pointing out the waveform. And it works as a timeline, a kind of map, and everybody can read it. Mm-hmm. You know, any kind of musician or singer can read it straight away. Are we done?
Before we end, I want to speak on for both of us and saying a special big thank you to the three graces who put this on.
Totally, yeah.
It's just been such an honor to be here, and you guys have just rocked it and done such a great show. So,
yeah. Thank you guys.